Next on our schedule is Alan Higger. He's a beloved member of the physics department. He got his PhD in Berkeley, and he moved to UCSB in 1992. Since this is after 1979, I would imagine that Walter was involved in that somehow. Alan is also a Nobel Prize winner in chemistry from 2000, and I'm sure that, he went to ask Walter for advice of what to do. I've been told by Walter that he might even be thinking about retiring one of these days. So that's what's in store for our Nobel Prize winners. Go ahead, Walter.
It's an honor for me to be here. Walter and I have laughed together. We've cried together. We worked together. So it's really an honor for me to be here. I was trying to figure out what I should talk about. You know, all my students and postdocs do DFT calculations every day. It's become so much a thing, and I think nobody even refers to Walter. That's when you really made it, when you have done something that is so well known, it doesn't need to be referred to. So I don't want to talk about that.
I just changed my name. My name is Spears.
So I reached back to some work that I did nearly 40 years ago, 45, when my hair was red. And it's singularly interesting then and still today. As you know, I have a propensity for being interested in bizarre materials. And this is perhaps the most bizarre material that I've ever run into. So this is a crystal. I've had this for 45 years. It's a beautiful golden color, and I'll show you that it's not an accident. I mean, it's a golden color because the plasma frequency is exactly like that of gold. Now, you might ask, why is it in this peculiar bottle? And the answer is that it is extremely air sensitive. And if you if it's seized air, it just turns into ash in no time at all. So you have to be courageous to take on a problem like that, where everything has to be done, you know, in glove box and extreme care, etc. But I still have it, and it's still golden. Now I'll show you why. So this is a crystal, and you can do a crystal structure with X-rays. And when you do that, you find the structure, you find these linear chains of mercury atoms. You find these linear chains of mercury atoms running through the structure, some this way, some this way. The distance between them is very short, even less than that in pure liquid mercury. But it turns out that that distance is not commensurate with the lattice constant of the crystal to these mercury chains are incommensurate with the crystal in which they reside. But they are metals. Mercury chains are metals. This is a classic Drude reflectance. You cannot see any deviation from the data to the simple Drude theory. Plasma frequency about 4.8. Looks like gold because it has the same reflectance. We have the advantage, however, from that you get, by the, remember these numbers, I mean you get high conductivity, order 10 to the fourth at room temperature. We have the advantage that these crystals have facets. So I can look at different facets, and I notice, you know, that if I bring the light in at 90 degrees, there's no reflectance. So these chains are one-dimensional. The metallic parallel, it's a metal parallel to the mercury chains. And it's not metallic perpendicular to the mercury chains. Now, when you have one-dimensional chains of this kind, one naturally thinks of the calculation of the giant cone anomaly and the Linhart function that Walter calculated. Here it is at t equals zero, and it grows logarithmically. What that screening does, in a simplest sense, is give rise to a soft mode in the phonon spectrum, and eventually to a phase transition, which is called the Pyrrhos transition. I don't know why it's called the Pyrrhos transition. It should have been called the cone transition. So, I'm just emphasizing again that it's an incommensurate system. These metallic mercury chains are incommensurate with the lattice. Now, this spacing is constant at all temperatures. So it's perfectly harmonic forces. Crystal is not. You cool a crystal, it shrinks, like most crystals. So if you look closely, when you cool it, you see little beads of mercury coming out the end. And when you warm it up, they go back in. So the result is that we have an example of one-dimensional lattice dynamics. This is, as far as I know, this is the only example. There are many examples of one-dimensional or quasi-one-dimensional electronic systems. But one-dimensional lattice dynamics are, as far as I know, this is the only example. And there's also a very weak interchain electronic coupling, so we have simultaneously an electronic structure which is one-dimensional. This is a graph of the phonon spectrum taken from neutron diffraction. And you see this bizarre effect. I mean, 3D phonons with one sound velocity, and then coming off this point, because of the weird number here, a steeper phonon curve associated with these one-dimensional chains, like completely separate system. The numbers are interesting. Sound velocity is about twice as high for these one-dimensional chains because the mercury atoms are so very close together, strongly interact. Now, on the last page, I believe it is, of Landau and Lifshitz's book, famous book on statistical physics, they prove in a very simple way that there's no long-range order in a one-dimensional system. And the example is a ferromagnet. Take an Ising model. This is the ground state. I put in a spin flip someplace. And the free energy looks like that. So there's a long, it ends up that there's a long correlation length. But for n large, with many such defects, there will be many such defects at random sites, and there will be no long-range order in one dimension. So what does that mean here? It means that that chain of mercury must be a liquid. There's no long-range order. So we used energy dispersive X-ray. Usually when you do X-ray diffraction, you take the sharp line and you use that sharp line to do diffraction. But there's, of course, a broad background. And we use the broad background to measure SFQ out to very high Q values. That's what you see. The 001 peak looks very sharp. It looks like a delta function. But by the time you get out here, you can see that there is a real width, and that width gets broader and broader and broader and broader. And you can calculate that. It's a simple enough problem that you can calculate the one-dimensional structure factor, S of Q. And my student at that time, Richard Spall, did that. Nice paper, working with Takeshi Agami, whose apparatus we were using for the X-ray work. After this paper was published, I got a note from, I don't remember who, but somebody pointed out to me that Schrödinger had solved this problem of the one-dimensional lattice dynamics in 1920 or something like that, as an exercise, and had published it. But there it is. It's a liquid. This is the liquid structure factor. So you have to think about what that means. It's no long-range order. And because of that, when you look at the scattering, there's nothing at zero energy. Not a Bragg peak. But when you do X-ray diffraction, which integrate, there's no energy resolution, what you see is inelastic scattering from these low-lying photons. And that's what they thought when they first did the X-rays, that this was really a crystal, but in that crystal there are these one-dimensional liquids. When you look at the low-temperature specific heat, you see a very large linear term when you plot C over T versus T squared. Typically, when you look at that, you say, well, this intercept has to do with the density of states of the metal, and this is phonon-like. But here, we know from the night shift, et cetera, that the density of states is just far too small. cannot account for that large linear term. It comes from the lattice dynamics. And Moses, who's still here with me, measured that. And here you see the data again, but this term, which is this intercept, is a specific heat contribution from a one-dimensional lattice where the appropriate Debye temperature is 540 degrees Kelvin. Sound velocity is about the same as that which you infer from that, same as that which we got from the neutron data. So we have one-dimensional lattice dynamics, as I said, the only known example. What about the transport properties? So in the plane, these chains are running this way and this way. So if you make measurements, you know, in the plane of this crystal, this is what you see. You see a strongly temperature-dependent resistivity, which, if you look carefully, seems to have no residual resistivity. This is bizarre. There are defects all over the place, just from the structure and just from the fact that it's a liquid. But it looks like there's no residual resistivity. You do see anisotropy, but since the temperature dependence is the same, I don't know that that anisotropy is intrinsic, maybe in fact much greater. But the particularly interesting thing here is this apparent absence, not apparent, absence of residual resistivity. You can turn on a residual resistivity by putting in a magnetic field. You can see that here. I guess I should use this one. You can see that here in zero field, no residual resistance. Modestly high field, same curve, but pushed up. We understood this at one time. Paper was published. I couldn't reproduce the argument. Forgot to look it up. But you can reference this here. Remarkably interesting. It has to do with the fact that the Fermi surface has, you know, slight curvature around the edges. When you look at the that field dependence carefully, remarkably high mobilities, you know, 10 to the fifth, implying mean free paths of order 50 microns in this one-dimensional system, which is a liquid. Now, from the cone anomaly, from the existence of the cone anomaly, we would expect that the phonon spectrum of those one-dimensional chains would be screened and it could soften. And we would see a Pyrrhos instability. But of course, as you know, we don't. It doesn't become an insulator. There's no sign of a gap forming. The resistivity is very low, and I emphasize again, there's no sign of a residual resistivity as the temperature approaches zero. So, what's wrong? I mean, why not? Well, in fact, I don't know. There's no signature of the giant cone anomaly. There's no Pyrrhus instability. Someone commented to me that maybe I should look at that as in the context of a Luttinger liquid with attractive interactions. But I don't exactly know what that means. But there's a very interesting theoretical problem here. These are astounding data in their own, but in the context of the fact that the lattice dynamics are such that it's a liquid, even more interesting. So I'll stop with that. I would really be delighted if someone here were sufficiently interested in this problem to go back to that extensive literature and help me understand what is going on. This, in fact, is my most favorite work. I'm more fond of it than anything else that I've ever done. But the number of citations is just minuscule. But I think, honestly, it should be in every textbook. It's a really classic example. So, happy birthday. Thanks for listening. And I should comment that this work was done, as I said, 45 years ago, just when we were starting our initial work on semiconducting and metallic polymers. It's perhaps the most fundamental work ever done on one-dimensional phenomena in solids. And the people who did it, unfortunately, are all gone. I used to go up to Brookhaven and work with Gen Charani, Vic Emery. Most of those data were taken, the neutron data were taken by Charani and Axe. Arnold Denenstein was the only one who could deal with contacts to this stuff in, you know, in vacuum, et cetera. And you'll notice some other familiar names here, too. My colleague Alan McDarmid was working with me on this. Mayor Vega and Mark Asbell. So it goes way back into my past, and it relates, sort of. The mystery is, why not? Why isn't there a Pyrrhus instability? With that, I'll close.
Okay, we have time for some questions.
Alan, I'm trying to remember another material. I think it's KDP, but it was a material that had, I think, one-dimensional chains of platinum surrounded by...
Yes, but as far as I know...
And it showed a strong cone one-dimensional anomaly.
Yeah, and of course the TTF-TCNQs, and I mean, many other of the one-dimensional systems that we studied always did that. This is the only one that did not.
And it somehow appears, from what you've told us, that the system itself is almost decoupled from the lattice. The mercury.
Yes, entity. They're incommensurate. They move. Even harmonic, so the, as I said, remarkable. Distance stays the same when you cool the crystal, but the lattice constant changes. And so the delta changes, function of temperature, and completely reversible.
just don't understand how that can be. How can these chains be so completely decoupled from this lattice that they can remain incommensurate down to very low temperatures, extreme?
I don't know. I mean, they're very, I don't know. What can I say? They're very close. It's like a rod. I mean, if you look at the, but I don't know. There it is. They stay one-dimensional lattice dynamic, even at such low temperatures.
Yeah, related to that, even at low temperatures, is it known that, or is it believed that it will stay liquid all the way down as far as you can go, or is there believed that there'll be some temperature at which it finally lock up?
Well, I think that's a question of weak forces between the chains and the lattice. Must be some temperature where they lock in. But if they're incommensurate, it's not easy. They can't lock in without having disclinations. So locking in would cost energy, and maybe not.
So Alan, how was the material discovered, aka, I mean, why was anybody messing with it?
Why in the world would anyone ever make this? Well, there was I haven't seen him in many years. There was a chemist in Canada who was interested in studying the trivalent mercury. And so he made this trivalent mercury, but it didn't come out to be three for the reasons that you saw. When we saw that publication of the initial X-ray paper, we knew there was something very interesting and strange. So it's like always, it's an accident. But I like bizarre materials.
Okay, I think we can thank Alan again. And we have a 10-minute recess.